Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Zion Day. Zion Williamson Day, because tonight is the NBA draft lottery. Tonight is the night where we find out where Zion is going to be. And the fact is, there has not been a bigger, more anticipated draft lottery since LeBron came out. Maybe even before that, back to Pat Ewing and the frozen envelope, allegedly. Stay in your shoes, Stern. You're retired. Nobody misses you. Nobody cares what you think. Anyway, the most exotic or the most exciting of the realistic options, according to the odds, is Atlanta. The Hawks have a 10.5% chance of getting the first pick. And if the Hawks were to end up with that, look the hell out. For instance, can you imagine Zion and Trae Young together for the next 10 to 15 years? Throw in John Collins, and the ATL would be the new Lob City. The Atlanta Highlight Factory would be back and better than ever. Then you've got the Bulls. The Bulls have a 12.5% chance of getting that number one pick. And honestly, if they do, well, who cares? Pretty much nobody. And then you've got the three teams with the best chance after that. The three worst teams all have a 14% chance this evening. Take Cleveland. Cleveland could cap off a hell of a 48-hour period by getting John Beilein and then chasing that with Zion. I've got no idea what that means, but I'll be damned if that wouldn't be interesting to me. Then you've got Phoenix, who actually needs a point guard more than they need Zion, but there's no way you turn down Zion, right? No way. Regardless of need, there's no way you turn that guy down. And then you've got a roster which would include Devin Booker, DeAndre Ayton, Zion, and more. No wonder Monty Williams wanted nothing to do with the Lakers. Well, that and the fact that the Lakers are a bleep show. More on that later on. And then you've got the team with the best chance. That, of course, is the New York Knicks. Zion Williamson, New York Knick. Can you imagine the reaction in the city if that happens? Alvin, hit it.
Say go, New York. Go, New York.
That song would be bumping throughout the entire city. Winning the lottery tonight would be the Knicks' biggest win since they actually won an NBA title nearly a half a century ago. The Knicks need this. The Knicks have to have this. And not because the state of the franchise depends on it, because it doesn't. The Knicks have been incredibly overrated, tremendously unsuccessful. It's been like that for years, yet somehow they just keep right on rolling. No, they need to win tonight because they need to win something. Win the draft lottery tonight, and you should raise a banner in the rafters at MSG. You know, right next to that Billy Joel banner. Yeah, they've got a Billy Joel banner up there. They do. What the hell does that say about your basketball team that a piano man has got more banners in your rafters lately than your basketball team does? And because the Knicks do need this so badly, the New York Post has enlisted the help of a priest, a rabbi, and witches, quote, to break the Knicks' curse ahead of the lottery. Look, I understand what's going on here. I know what you're about. It's just a newspaper trying to get some free pub and to move some fish wrap. But the Knicks don't have a curse. That's not what's going on here. They don't have a curse, at least not one that you can remove with a priest, a rabbi, or witches. Now, they don't have a curse. What they have is a terrible owner. It's that simple. I mean, it'd be a lot cooler if Jerome James did put a curse on MSG, or if Eddie Curry cast a spell on the court on his way out. Now, that'd be awesome, but that's not what happened. The Knicks' problems are not because of some bitter old Knicks player, but rather because of a bitter old Knicks owner. The Knicks are terrible because he's terrible and has a history of hiring terrible people, which is why I do not want Zion to go to the Knicks. That's why we all need to summon all of our forces and energy to make sure that the Knicks do not win the lottery tonight. Don't get it twisted. I don't hate Knicks fans. I like Knicks fans. I want nothing but good things for them. The problem is, when good things go to the Knicks, they turn to crap. When good things go to the Knicks, they become bad. Everything that has ever gone to the Knicks has become terrible. And we cannot afford to have one of the best things ever, Zion, become terrible. A generational talent. In any normal world, it would be incredible for him to go to New York. The biggest young star in the biggest city would be amazing. But in this world, in the one where the Knicks have been revolting and a mess for decades, Zion going there is only going to end in sorrow and tragedy. As a freshman at Duke, he proved to be a transcendent player. But transcending the Knicks might be too tough for even Zion. The only good thing about the Knicks possibly winning the draft lottery is that they might actually trade that pick. This is how Knicks they are. Because if you remember, the Knicks do have the possibility of signing two max free agents this summer. So, if you can sign two max free agents and then trade the Zion pick to get another, you've got yourself a super team overnight. Get the best player in generations and then trade them away because you think you can win right now. You think you can go from being the worst team in the NBA to winning right now. And that'd be the most Knicks thing ever. It'd be incredible. The only thing more Knicks and more awesome would be to get that first pick and the chance to have Zion, trade him, and assemble some kind of Frankenstein super team that ends up right back in the lottery next year. That'd be so Knicks. Go New York. Go New York. Go New York. Go. If they get this guy, and they could. Dan Wojcicki is my guest. Dan, what's going on? How are you?
I know a dog that'll be very happy to hear you talk about him, Jim. I'm sure that tail is wagging somewhere.
Dude, you got to tell the story behind that. Why did you name that dog B. Arthur?
Well, so we wanted to get a female golden doodle, and obviously B. Arthur, tremendous golden girl. We're like, oh, that'd be a fun dog name. They were all out of girls, so we just slapped a period behind that B. And, yeah, it's kind of an unnamed first initial now. And now we've got a male dog named B. Arthur.
Well done. Expect no less. Dan Wojcicki joining us, B. Arthur. All right, so game one of the Western Conference Finals gets underway tonight, as I mentioned. Dan, before we get to that, what do you make of the second round of the NBA playoffs? Was there enough drama for you?
Boy, yeah, no, it was great. I had thought that the Eastern Conference had a chance, all four series, to be just super fun, just because of kind of not only for what it meant in terms of getting teams to the conference finals and moving towards the finals, but, you know, the implications. You looked at a Philadelphia roster that could be very in flux, a coaching situation that we weren't sure about. Obviously, some of that's been settled, since. You look at the Boston Celtics, same thing. A roster that could look very, very differently last year. Toronto, what's going to happen with Kawhi Leonard? Does any of this matter? You had all of that stuff happening out east. And then on top of it, you had, the best player in the world get hurt in the West. You had the Rockets with the best opportunity they'll probably ever have to get past the Warriors, squandering it. And then you had a great seven-game series between Portland and Denver. I mean, it's just the league is in a really good spot right now, I think, in terms of competitiveness, in terms of storylines, not to mention everything that happened, involving teams that weren't even in the playoffs. It was a good few weeks, I think, for the league office in terms of, getting NBA chatter out there.
Dan Wojcicki is joining us. All right, so what about the matchup in the West? You've got Portland, and it was one thing to bounce back and beat OKC the way they did, but then to come back from three games down, 3-2 down, and then win a game 7 on the road against Denver was something else. So there's a confidence and a belief that this Blazers team has been pretty remarkable, but how different is the challenge they face now with Golden State, even without Kevin Durant?
Well, I mean, I think, look, right? Like, the Warriors, without Kevin Durant and with Steph Curry, have been almost unbeatable since KD joined the team. I think they're 30-4 in those games. Obviously won a closeout game on the road, without Kevin Durant. And they'll be without him, I would imagine, for a pretty decent chunk of this series. The Warriors are the Warriors, right? This is a monumental test. I think the only thing that I would say in terms of Portland is that this is a team that has been counted out all season. When you looked at the way the Western Conference shook out last summer and you looked at sort of, the LeBron moving west and the presumption that the Lakers would make the playoffs, you talk to people around the league and they would try to figure out, well, what team isn't going to make the playoffs, And Portland was a popular answer. They didn't appear to get a lot better in the summer. They had Seth Curry. Rodney Hood in a trade later down the line, but it wasn't like a team that got a ton better. And here they are, though. This is a team that has been in the top part of the Western Conference here for, you know, three of the last 4 years. Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum are just a bear to guard. They're very hard to defend. And, you know, maybe we should stop being surprised by their surprises. I wrote something today in the LA Times where earlier this year I talked to CJ McCollum about, I do a series called Best Game Ever. And I had asked him about that, and I had assumed that he would have said the game he played in the NCAA tournament against Duke, maybe, kind of his sort of introduction to the world as a basketball player and as a potential draft pick. And he took the game before that, the game that got him there, because he understood that if they hadn't won that conference tournament, if they hadn't beaten Bucknell, he might not have been in the tournament. He might not have gotten that chance. And maybe that's what this has been for them. Maybe this is just the moment before the big moment. And I think if you're a Portland fan, that's what you have to hope.
Contractors can rely on Ferguson to provide a winning game plan for any job, any day. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can choose from thousands of products to order online and pick up in store, which makes doing business with Ferguson the easiest part of your day. Dan Wojcicki is a national NBA writer for the Los Angeles Times. Dan, let me ask you about something you said recently about Steph Curry. You made the distinction that Curry is not Golden State's best player, but he is their most important player. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think Kevin Durant, I think he's the best player in the NBA. If not, he's second. He's certainly been, one of the top two in the playoffs, him and Kawhi Leonard. But I think kind of like the gasoline or the engine, what makes the Warriors run like the Warriors is Steph Curry. And what I mean by that is his ability to stretch defenses. It's the way that the ball kind of zips around. It's sort of, his emotion. He's kind of, I think, an underrated emotional leader on that team. A lot of times people point towards Draymond Green. I think, Steph Curry is right there in terms of somebody who can kind of inject life into the Warriors and always seems to he has this great love affair with like the big moment, right? Seems like he is shooting 80% on shots in Oracle Arena over his career that like really matter. And so I look at that and you look at those numbers, that 30-4 record. And I think that's what that is. It's a style of play type of thing. With Kevin Durant, the ball sticks a little bit, and it should. The ball should stick with Kevin Durant. He might be the greatest offensive player ever, or certainly the hardest to guard. But for the Warriors, when they're operating, I think sometimes at prime efficiency, it's what we saw in the second half of Game 6, the ball flying around, making its way into Steph Curry's hands. And some of those shots, they might only count for three on the scoreboard. But, man, they feel like 5, 6, 7 points when you're in the arena. They're just backbreakers.
Dan Wojcicki joining us. Dan, back to that point about how Kevin Durant might be the best offensive player ever. You raised the question on Twitter earlier this month, quote, are we sure, like sure, that Kawhi Leonard isn't the best player in the world, end quote. That was earlier this month. How would you answer that question right now?
I mean, it's tough, right? I mean, I think those are the two guys. And then Giannis is right there too. But what we've seen from Kawhi Leonard, I think, healthy, shooting 60% from the field, hitting obviously huge shots in every series so far, but a really magical kind of, game 7 buzzer beater. That's the type of stuff you dream about in driveways, right? That's not real life. That's fantasy. To hit a shot like that. It's what an incredible moment for him. But I mean, he's been terrific on offense, still can take over games on the defensive end in a way that Kevin Durant, I don't think, can. I'm very curious to see what he's going to look like against a really good Milwaukee Bucks defense, and obviously going to be tested plenty. He's going to catch Giannis, I think, on a lot of switches. I'm expecting kind of to watch those two guys at times go at it. But he has a stake, or he has a claim at kind of that title in this league. He's been that good in the playoffs. I think Toronto has done a lot to help their case to re-sign him by keeping him healthy, by putting him in this position, by helping get him ready to be able to go 40-plus minutes in these playoff games, not worry about injuries, not worry about health. I think they've done a lot to kind of help their free agency pitch to Kawhi.
All right, so these guys have done everything they could to keep him there. However, the Clippers have had somebody in a building to watch him and scout him almost every single night this season, if not every single night. Now, you covered the Clippers back in the day during some really interesting times. Did you ever think, Dan, you would see a time where the Clippers would be the more stable, better-run organization and a more attractive free agent destination than Big Brother in the same building?
No, you know, it's a surprise, and I think maybe it shouldn't be, because the more you're around the NBA, I think, and the more you kind of study teams and what makes rosters work and what makes organizations successful, ownership is one of those things that just, you can't undersell the importance of ownership. And when you look at what Steve Ballmer's done, not only financially, right? Like, look at their summer gym. They had two front office candidates, Trent Redden, Michael Winger, important guys sort of in their front office infrastructure, have opportunities elsewhere. Michael Winger had a chance to interview for the Minnesota Timberwolves job. Trent Redden had a chance to go work with David Griffin in New Orleans. But the Clippers were able to step up and keep both guys, right? And yeah, they can sell unfinished business and all of that stuff, but I'm sure there were raises involved, because the Clippers know, and Steve Ballmer knows, there's no salary cap for a front office. You can pay whatever you want to have the best general managers. You can pay whatever you want to have the best scouting, to have the best analytics team, to have the best training staff and training equipment. There's no cap on any of that stuff. And I've talked to Steve Ballmer about this, and I think you know, he understands that you can control what you can control. That's a Ballmer phrase that he likes. And that's one of the things that he knows he can control, is he can take out the checkbook and he can write big checks to keep the coaches they want, to keep the front office guys that they want to try to keep. And, you know, there's a power in that infrastructure. And I think you look across the hall at the Lakers right now and you look at the voices that are important, some of them don't work for the team. It's not as robust of a front office. Ownership is much more involved, I think, in the decision-making than it is across the hall where people are empowered. I think it's a pretty stark contrast when you look at what the Clippers have done under Steve Ballmer in terms of just kind of building a culture of stability. And you look at the Lakers, where if they're trying to sell that they're stable to free agents, I think they're barking up the wrong tree. You know, you had Magic Johnson quit, telling people like me before he told LeBron James, which is totally insane. And then now he's still, a little bit a part of the process. You have Linda Rambis and you have Kurt Rambis, emerging as really, really important voices. You have a guy, Rob Pelinka, that, doesn't have a ton of respect around the league, and he's been elevated now through all of this. And they hired their third coaching choice because they cheaped out on Ty Lue. This hasn't been sort of the stellar start to, maybe the most important summer that they've had in the last decade. The clock's ticking on LeBron James, and they've got to move. You look across the hall, and the Clippers, even if they don't land Kawhi Leonard, they are in really good position moving forward for the next 3-4 seasons, and they've given themselves options. The Lakers don't have as many.
Hey, Dan, really quickly, as a follow, how and why do the Rambises have so much power and influence over Jeannie Buss? Exactly what is that about?
Well, I mean, I think, Linda and Jeannie are friends for multiple decades, Jim, and people have advisors and they have people that are close to them that they listen to. And I think that's been Linda for Jeannie for a long time. And obviously with Linda comes Kurt, who was hired, I think, last year. I was surprised. I assumed he'd already worked for the Lakers. I mean, it feels like he's worked there his whole life. It's either there or the Knicks. And I think that sort of has become sort of her inner circle. Earlier this year, the Times kind of had a big story where we found emails between some representatives from MSG and from, and Jeannie Buss. And Linda Rambis is on these emails, And I remember at the time when the story came out, talking to people saying, hey, congratulations, you just stumbled into the hierarchy. That's who's important here. That's one and two on that email chain. And these are talking about maybe going back to play at the Forum type emails. And Linda Rambis is there. She's got a voice on all of this stuff. And I think it's, the result of a multi-decade relationship with ownership.
Hey, listen, you have a friend. Be as close as you want. Have a friend. I got no problem with that. I'm not saying who she should be friends with. I got no problem with that. He is a national NBA writer for the LA Times. He is a friend of the program. And he is the owner of a dog named B. Arthur. With the letter B. B. Arthur. Dan, great job. Good to have you back. I appreciate it.
All right, Jim, take care. If you need me to name some horses, let me know.
You clones know I am a paid professional. And as a pro at keeping you clones in line and interviewing the right people in sports, I've got some simple advice for you. It can help you. When you're looking for pro tips on vehicle maintenance or repair, look no further than O'Reilly Auto Parts. Whether it comes to replacing your battery, getting advice on proper car maintenance, or just getting the best bang for your buck, their expert team can help you out every step of the way. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. So let me go back to the Lakers. The Lake Show has turned into the ultimate clown show. I mean, they're a laughingstock. There's so much garbage surrounding that team right now and that organization, it's nearly impossible to even keep track of. Starting with, but not limited to, Magic quitting without telling anybody. Luke Walton fired. No replacement for Magic. Jeannie Buss apparently decides to double down on Rob Pelinka with input from Linda Rambis and her husband, Kurt. Monty Williams is a candidate for the head coaching job. Ty Lue is a candidate for the head coaching job. Monty Williams is hired by the Suns. The Lakers set themselves on fire in their attempt to force Lue into a deal. So Ty Lue walks. They hire Frank Vogel as head coach, but make him take Jason Kidd as his assistant. And now there literally is smoke gathering about a possible trade involving LeBron James. Like, that's a hell of a lot. While at the same time, it's not even all of it. But just so we're clear, Magic Johnson quit the Lakers on April 9th. Today is May 14th. That's 5 weeks. All that crap went down in 5 weeks' time. Magic quit right at the end of the regular season, and the conference finals haven't even started yet. That's how quickly this thing has gone that terribly. That's how badly this franchise is bleeding right now. I mean, better yet, another way of looking at it, LeBron James has barely been a Laker for 10 months, and there are already rumors about him being traded. A rival executive told Tom Haberstroh, quote, "I think they very well might explore that," end quote. And in this case, that they're talking about is the Sixers' interest in a possible trade involving Ben Simmons and LeBron James. Again, that's not coming from the Sixers themselves, but from a rival executive. And there are a ton of issues involved that would have to be resolved to make that deal in terms of the salary cap, etc. I mean, it's a long shot. But the fact that we're even talking about this, the fact that anybody would even float or talk about that is pretty mind-blowing. But you know what? Okay. All right. I'll play along. Why don't we start with the fact that LeBron is 34 and Simmons is only 22. And not only is LeBron 34, but he'll be 35 at the end of the year, right? And he didn't just turn 34 overnight. 34. He was 33 when he signed. Him turning 34 was a lock. 34. Same with 35. This is nothing new. But even at 34, and even 34. Running with the garbage that they surrounded him with, garbage that he undoubtedly wanted and signed off on, he still averaged 27, 9, and 8. Now, don't get this twisted either. Simmons potentially is a special player. Like, if this guy could ever get a legitimate jumper, he could be a perennial MVP candidate. I mean, I think that highly of the guy, if he could shoot it. But how would that guy fit in with Lonzo Ball? Again, I'm just kind of playing along with this. Can you imagine Simmons and Lonzo Ball? You probably don't want to put two of the worst shooters ever on the same team, on the same floor, at the same time, right? And not that Simmons would be some kind of great fit with Brandon Ingram either. And then on top of all of that, you're going to tell me that you would trust the Lakers organization, this Lakers organization, to pair him with the right talent. Does anybody anywhere trust the Laker regime right now? Who the hell is running it? Who's in charge? Jeannie Buss? Kurt Rambis? Better yet, Linda Rambis? I mean, is Buss going to turn to Smush Parker and his wife for additional counsel? Or is Samaki Walker and his wife going to come take over the Laker rebuild? Or does it fall on that Rob Lowe lookalike, Rob Pelinka? Hell, the real Rob Lowe will probably end up with that job. Which brings me back to the LeBron rumors. And more importantly, where they're coming from. Because if they're coming from LeBron's camp, if that's how that started, and this guy wants out, who the hell would blame him? Did you see the last 5 weeks? If I'm him, I'm looking around at this clown show and I'm thinking, I got to get the hell out of here as quickly as possible. I mean, suddenly Philadelphia and Cleveland, anywhere that's not LA, looks a hell of a lot better. But what if the rumors aren't coming from him and his camp? What if they're coming from the Lakers? You talk about the most Nick thing ever. That would be the most Laker thing ever. And really pretty moronic. Especially the continuing rap that the Lakers are irritated or bothered by the fact that they might seem like they're beholden to LeBron. Like the idea that they don't like people thinking that it's LeBron calling the shots and not the Rambises or Pelinka or Magic from afar. I mean, I'm not sure what's more idiotic right now. Signing him, knowing that people will think that he's calling the shots, or thinking that you're doing a better job of calling the shots. Lakers have not won a playoff game since 2012. LeBron has been to the finals every year since 2011. The year you won 27 games, he was in the finals. The year you won 21 games, finals. 17 games, finals. 26 games, finals. 35 games, finals. What I'm saying is, maybe this guy's way is better. Maybe LeBron does know something, because it sure seems like the Lakers don't know jack. And if Linda and Kurt Rambis really are the ones who are calling the shots with Jeannie Buss, maybe LeBron knows more about winning than the executive director of special projects and a guy whose career coaching record is 65 and 164. Look, I get that Linda Rambis and Jeannie Buss have been tight for like 40 years, but other than being friends, I don't know why Linda and Kurt are a part of this, much less as big a part of this as reportedly they are. Kurt's resume is a disaster. And even if Linda's is great, it still has not been good enough to make them postseason contenders or even get them to the playoffs in the last 6 years. I mean, it would be so Lakers to whiff on every free agent for years, then have arguably the greatest player in league history fall right into their laps, and then less than a year later, they want to trade him because of some stupid power struggle. Like, oh no, we don't like that it appears that he's calling all the shots. Let's just go ahead and trade him. They signed the best player of a generation, and now reportedly, allegedly regret it? That's perfect. And now this crack front office is supposed to appeal to free agents in a matter of weeks. Go to free agents. Yeah, good luck with that. Any other team, I'd say there is no way that a LeBron trade happens. The LA Lakers and the way they've puked all over themselves for the past 5 weeks, I'd say that it could happen. And if it does, it would be the most Laker thing ever. The only question now is, who is going to make that deal if it goes down? Kurt Rambis? Linda Rambis? Or is Jeannie Buss going to just bring in Devin George and his wife to make that deal? Is Cedric Ceballos and his old lady in the building yet? And then why stop there, right? You know who they should bring in as a cap specialist? Sasha. How about a director of cost analysis? How about Adam Morrison? Terry Teagle should be their information technology director. Hey, you know who should be the director of game ops? My man, Eldon Campbell. You wish Nick Van Exel would step back in that building. That's not happening. Lots to talk to Michael McCann about. Michael, nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me back.
Good to have you back. Thanks so much. All right, so yesterday, Judge Leonard Hanser of the Palm Beach County Court granted a motion to suppress videos and any other evidence obtained pursuant to a search warrant that involved Bogcraft at the Orchids of Asia Day Spa back in January. Michael, can you break that down for us? Exactly what does granting that motion to suppress mean?
So, Jim, the most important point is that the granting of the motion means prosecutors can't use the spa videos, the videos where Kraft is videotape having sexual experiences with multiple women in the spa. That evidence is now inadmissible. But it goes beyond that. Even the traffic stop where Kraft had been in a Bentley, stopped after he was at the spa, that's also thrown out. So prosecutors are now left really with only the potential testimony of the women who Kraft saw and whether they would go on the witness stand, what they would recall. It's just a much weaker case. So a huge victory for Kraft in terms of not being convicted of this crime.
Michael McCann is my guest. So, Michael, what was the reasoning behind the judge's finding?
The basic reasoning, Jim, is that the warrant went too far, that it didn't have a limiting purpose. So basically, the prosecutor, law enforcement, for 5 days straight had videos running, recordings running inside the spa. So anyone who went in that spa, including people who were there for lawful reasons, just to have a massage, including women who entered the facility, all of these people who went to those spa rooms and got naked or otherwise disrobed, they are on video, videos that are stored in government servers. And the judge felt that that's really not how a search warrant should work. A search warrant should be tailored
to the individuals who are suspected of wrongdoing, not simply everyone who happens to go into a business. And he also noted that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy when they go to a spa and they go to a private room where they take their clothes off. The idea that the government is secretly watching them and recording what they're doing, and then that recording goes who knows where in terms of servers, that's really troubling. So the lack of minimization, the idea that they just simply didn't hit stop on the recording, that they videotaped everyone, that made it unconstitutional.
Legal expert Michael McCann joins us. So, Michael, if Kraft did not have the financial resources that he has to hire the attorneys that he hired, how different would this case be?
Yeah, most likely, Jim, a case like this gets resolved through a quick plea deal. Very basically, somebody does a plea deal. Often it's diversion where they don't necessarily agree to the crime, but they agree not to contest it. And then they pay a fine and they do a little community service. That's how these cases usually get resolved. He was never going to go to prison, and none of the men who were caught are going to go to prison. So that's how it probably would have ended. But his lawyers spent a lot of time on this, and they found some real deficiencies in the search warrant. And kudos to them. They were able to create a defense that convinced the judge.
We're talking to Michael McCann. Now, Michael, if you had to predict, how likely is it that video of Bob Kraft still eventually drops, either legally or illegally?
I've got to think it's more likely than not, and I say that because, one, we know that media companies, including national media companies, have petitioned the court for access to the videos because they argue that it's newsworthy, that Kraft was part of this very covered story in terms of media attention. So they're seeking it. Now, currently the videos are sealed, but that's subject to appeal. But there's a First Amendment right for news organizations. But even if the video remains sealed, I think the real risk is the unlawful disclosure. Who knows how many people have seen this video that work for the town of Jupiter or work for the state of Florida, or who could see it, and how many copies are there? You and I, we remember videos where there were actual video tapes. Now, of course, they're digital files. They're easily replicated. We have no idea how many files exist that are copies of what took place. So all it takes is for one person to sell it. And also, if it goes online, it stays online. Yeah, you can get a court order to take something down, but once something goes online, especially if a celebrity, there's always a reproduction of it.
The internet is in ink. Michael McCann joining us. So, Michael, when you look at it from an NFL standpoint, there is that matter of discipline from the league. If Kraft is not convicted of a crime, how does Roger Goodell go about approaching discipline for him?
Certainly Goodell could still punish him. Kraft has already admitted in an apology that he took part in these activities. He's apologized for them. His lawyers have called the recordings akin to pornography. So it's clear that he was there. This isn't a case of, well, was he actually the 77-year-old guy in that room? No, it was him. I think the question for Goodell is going to be, what does that mean? We know that prostitution is associated with degradation of women, particularly women of color, and there's an argument that Goodell needs to be mindful of that, including with sponsors, including with broadcasting companies that broadcast NFL games, that they could be offended by this, and that Kraft should be punished somehow. Now, what is somehow? We know that Jim Irsay, who pleaded out to a crime of driving while intoxicated, that compelled Goodell to suspend him for 6 games. But you could argue that's much worse because when you're driving while intoxicated, of course, you're a danger to others. That's different than what Kraft did. We also know that Jerry Richardson received a huge fine, about $2.75 million, and many thought was encouraged to sell the Panthers because of allegations that he mistreated women who worked for him. Different here because Kraft isn't accused of any kind of wrongdoing with women employees or anything like that. It's really about prostitution. My sense is that the most likely punishment would be a fine. I've never really thought that suspensions of owners make all that much sense. They're not playing, they're not coaching, they're not making personnel decisions. It seems more symbolic. And maybe Goodell will learn from the NBA, where Adam Silver had Mark Cuban pay about $10 million in response to allegations of workplace misconduct there, that it wasn't a fine, but it was a donation that Cuban made voluntarily, if you will. Maybe something similar like that will happen here.
Right. Or a draft pick. If you really want to get at an owner, you're right. They don't play, they don't coach, but if you take a draft pick, that'll get their attention. Michael, before you go, let me ask you about another legal issue. Bob Kraft is not the only legal matter in sports right now. There's also the ongoing legal situation surrounding this year's Kentucky Derby. Maximum Security's jockey, Luis Saez, was suspended 15 racing days by the three stewards. What was the argument behind that decision?
Yeah, the argument there is that Saez committed interference and that he did it in such a reckless way and a careless way that it warranted that kind of punishment. Now, 15 days may not sound like an enormous punishment, but in the horse racing world, 15 days is huge. In fact, it's five times what a normal suspension is, and it prohibits him from sort of plying his trade. He's not able to go and race, including at the Preakness. So this is a very severe punishment. Even though it doesn't sound that bad, 15 days, it's actually very, very strict. And he will likely challenge it through the appeals process, maybe go to court. He's going to argue that even if he committed an infraction, it was an accident rather than an act of carelessness.
Hmm. So where do the other legal matters surrounding the Kentucky Derby stand right now? What else is out there?
Well, we know that Gary West, the owner of Maximum Security, could sue over the disqualification. We know that there remains questions about what exactly happened. Why was there interference? Were other horses involved? Were other horses at fault? It's a story where if you ask three horse racing experts, you get three different answers as to what happened. So I suspect this will continue to play out.
Michael, one last thought. It was 1 year ago today that the federal ban on sports betting was struck down by the Supreme Court. How much has changed in the last year?
Well, but eight states have made sports betting legal. That includes, of course, Nevada, which has had it since 1949, but seven other states have joined. We know that another couple dozen are contemplating legislation to legalize sports betting. It has allowed states to make the decision that it's not a federal question, that the federal government shouldn't have the ability to deny states the right to determine on their own if they want to have legalized sports betting. And the industry has grown. We've seen the professional leagues, which had challenged the legalization of sports betting, now embrace it, including especially the NBA, but also the NFL as well. And I think we'll see leagues incorporate sports betting into their business models, that it will become part of the game. But there will be questions, Jim. We know that, you know, what happens if people bet on individual plays? That has often raised concerns that, you know, like in tennis, if somebody throws a play, you really can't prove that he or she did that, right? Because it's such a small thing. Will that happen in some of the sports that the major sports here in the United States? We'll see, but it's going to be interesting to see it play out.
Listen, I can't wait to talk to you about Johnny O. Johnny O has amazing clothing. Johnny O invented and patented the tweener button. What this is a hidden button between the second and third buttons featured on all Johnny O shirts. The tweener button is the first patented button to make sure that you're not too buttoned up and not too unbuttoned. What it does, it solves the age-old second button dilemma. Should you button one button or two? That's no longer a dilemma because of this. Every Johnny O shirt comes with their patented tweener button, so you're always going to look just right. It is a total game changer. And right now, you can use the promo code ROME for 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com at checkout through May 30th. I rock the Johnny O line all the time. 20% off the regular price button-ups, which come in a range of fabrics, patterns, and styles, and shipping is free for orders over $85. Johnny-O.com, promo code ROME, and get 20% off that first order and free shipping on orders over $85. Go to Johnny-O.com for your tweener shirt at 20% off, and make sure you check out the wide selection of shirts and other products ranging from polos to shorts, pants, swim, and more. Johnny-O.com. Just like that, we are now within 40 days until Smack-Off 25. In fact, to be exact, it's 38 days. So if you don't think that the heat is starting to get turned up, then you missed the last segment of Friday's show right after Alvin's week that was. This goes back to Friday. Because on Friday, I laid out the storylines that involve Brad and Corona and Leff and Laguna. They've each won two of the last four Smack-Offs. That prompted the Laguna Beach Bully to get in a parting shot right before the weekend.
Romy, the only power lines associated with Smack-Off 25 will be the lines I'm delivering. Meanwhile, Brad Smack-Off 25 is going to go just like his name is spelled, with a big D at the end.
Okay, we're not talking power lines. We're talking like betting lines. The odds are out, and Stucknut's got them. The odds for the 2019 Smack-Off did drop on Stucknut.com. Now, for those of you who do not know, the show's got a pretty amazing non-affiliated fan website that's run by Stephen Houston. And it's called Stucknut, and he's done this literally for decades. In addition to archiving every piece of audio ever, literally ever, and when I've got a question about the show, something that even I can't recall, that's who I go to. In addition to that, he also puts out his own Smackoff odds. I appreciate it because obviously I can't do it. I can't drop the odds, nor would I want to. But he does it, and it always inspires conversation every year at this time. And every year when he does it, somebody gets bent to hell about it and inevitably calls to say why it was such a bad idea and how Stucknut doesn't know Jack and that he's a dope. Take Matt in Van from last year. Matt said this when he saw his odds.
These asinine Stucknut Smackoff odds. This 40-year-old loser has done nothing but record your content for 20 years and put it on his own website. And that's somehow an accomplishment for this virgin. It's pathetic.
All right, so that was Matt in Vancouver. Coming in hard. Like, all this guy's done for the last 20 years is rip your content and put it on his website. What a virgin. So then Matt chased that with a 10th place showing. So probably, Matt, you should go ahead and phone in that apology or thumb out that apology to the nut anytime you want. This year, Steve-O, he's got Brad and Corona as the favorite to repeat. He's plus 200, meaning you lay a C note, you get two more back with the original bet. Leff is right behind Brad at plus 300. Hard to argue with the two guys that he's got on top. But arguably the biggest surprise in the early odds, Caleb in Green Bay, third on the board. He's at plus 500. You can't even value bet the Walrus anymore because he's so far up there. It's pretty interesting. Beyond that, if you go down to seventh on the board, you get Mike in Indy at plus 700. There's some value in that, assuming Mike ever shows up ever again. And that's a big if. But I'm sure the wise guys or the sharps in the jungle are looking at Mike in Indy at plus 700. You know, it's not whether or not the guy can win. He's won. It's whether or not he shows up. Rick in Buffalo is plus 800. And if his real-time odds didn't move a single point after his call yesterday, maybe they're not going to.
Well, I saw Stucknut posted his Smackoff odds the other night. And obviously that dope knows nothing about the show. He's got those two Canadian lames going off at 10 to 1. I wouldn't touch those hacks at 100 to 1. I've already referenced how pathetic Matt's top 10 list was last year. But Tyler's fit alarm gimmick doesn't get nearly the ridicule it deserves. That thing went over like a wet fart at a funeral.
Rick! So if you're wondering about the aforementioned, the Canadian bros, Matt and Van, plus 1,000. Tyler in Shredmonton, plus 1,100. Gotta wonder if that slight edge to Matt is going to fuel Tyler in any way. And wasn't Matt the guy who said that nobody is safe, foreign or domestic? And of all the golden ticket winners, once you isolate them, Stucknut has got Jeff in Southfield with the best odds at plus 1,200. And then the huge drop-off to Dan in Denver, he is plus 2,000. At the bottom of the board, Trapper, plus 3,000. Kind of fitting that the biggest horse racing junkie in the field would also have the longest odds. Speaking of long odds, yes, I'm well aware that the date for the Smackoff also happens to fall on World Giraffe Day. Because the date of the Smackoff is June 21st, and June 21st is the longest day of the year. So naturally, these long necks get their day on June 21st. I get it. Let me just say it right now. I don't need any giraffe family smack leading up to the event, and I sure as hell don't need it on the day of the event. This is a dignified competition of the best smack of the year, clowning Mike Glennon for being able to see over the nosebleed seats is not the best smack. Let it be a quinky-dink. It's a coincidence. Just keep moving. I don't need to hear from him that day or my man Merton Hanks or my other guy Harvey Williams. I don't need it. I don't want it. The Smackoff, Chris Bosch doesn't factor into any of this because the Smackoff will be here before you know it. 38 days to go from the BIC to Trapper and everybody in between, including Matt in LA, who did not get his ticket ripped today. Check out the odds right now if you're so inclined. Go to Stucknut.com. Stucknut.com. As I mentioned, one of the early favorites is this guy. the Walrus, Caleb in Green Bay. Caleb, what's going on? How are you?
I'm great, man. How are you doing today?
So good. Perfect.
Excellent, excellent. So I've noticed over the past few days there's been a lot of commotion over the smack-off odds that you just mentioned and the fact that your boy is opening the betting as the third choice on the board behind only Brad and Les. Maybe Steve knows something about my call that I don't, but he has my number, so nut. Anytime you want to text me that info would be sweet. But, Jim, the best part about it is how pissed off people are getting. I'm obviously trying to have fun with it, but you had two phone calls yesterday from guys in the field voicing their displeasure that my ticket is 5-1. First, it was Rick in Buffalo, and before he started calling the show years ago, I was unaware that it was possible to actually hear bad breath. I bet if I ever meet this cat, I could tell you within 3 seconds who was president the last time he went to the dentist. Hey, Caleb, it's nice to finally meet you. Oh, God, Gerald Ford, maybe early Jimmy Carter. Rick, the next time you call, switch your TV over to CBS Sports Network. If you see the XR4TI wearing gas masks, it's not because of Adam Hawk's patchouli stank or because the new guy didn't know about the moratorium on fish in the microwave. It's because you didn't mix in a Mentos before dialing, you demented hack. Jim, this guy constantly tweets about how he's the most interesting guest on the Woodscopes. First of all, that's like saying you're the best kisser in prison. Secondly, the only scope you need to be concerned about is bright green and kills 99.9% of germs. And Richard, as far as the fat jokes go, if I were you, I would not dive too deep into the realm of personal appearance. You look like Scott Van Pelt mated with an Oompa Loompa, then pushed it into oncoming traffic. I haven't seen a dome that jacked up since Dealey Plaza 1963. Then we have that walking Florida man headline, Mark in Boston. I don't want to go too hard on him because his school just lost their only coach who consistently beat Ohio State. But Jim, this guy's Twitter handle is The Nomad. A lot of people don't know why, but I do. It's because he wanders aimlessly around the jungle in between obscurity and anonymity. It's always nice to get wrestling jokes from a guy who's a married father of four children. Yes, Mark, because you're having so much more sex than I am. The wife lets you hit it once every Boston World Series and only to procreate, but somehow I'm the loser because I'm not married. I've seen more intelligent Marks at a timeshare presentation. When the date comes that I can finally slide into home plate, at least I won't sing the same song as you do in the shower the next morning. We all love the Red Sox. Lastly, Jim, I want to say farewell to Keith Arnold. He's always been super nice to me. I don't think the show is going to be the same without him. Keith, if you want to slide over a couple spots and peek into that crystal ball on your left, I'm sure you will see a very bright future for yourself. Take care. Come back and see us sometime. Jim, I'm out. On Wisconsin.
On Wisconsin. Is there anybody anywhere who still thinks that that guy should not be plus 500? Listen, I can't wait to talk to you about Johnny O. Johnny O has amazing clothing. Johnny O invented and patented the tweener button. What this is a hidden button between the second and third buttons featured on all Johnny O shirts. The tweener button is the first patented button to make sure that you're not too buttoned up and not too unbuttoned. What it does, it solves the age-old second button dilemma. Should you button one button or two? That's no longer a dilemma because of this. Every Johnny O shirt comes with their patented tweener button, so you're always going to look just right. It is a total game changer. And right now, you can use the promo code ROME for 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com at checkout through May 30th. I rock the Johnny O line all the time. 20% off the regular price button-ups, which come in a range of fabrics, patterns, and styles, and shipping is free for orders over $85. Johnny-O.com, promo code ROME, and get 20% off that first order and free shipping on orders over $85. Go to Johnny-O.com for your tweener shirt at 20% off, and make sure you check out the wide selection of shirts and other products ranging from polos to shorts, pants, swim, and more. Johnny-O.com. Wilder v. Brazil, Saturday night, 9 p.m. It's live on Showtime. Deontay, good to have you back. How are you?
What's going on, Jim? I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Good, good. Good to have you back. All right, so let me talk about that fight coming up on Saturday night in Brooklyn. You're going to face Dominic Brazil. He's the mandatory challenger for you, and you've said sometimes, Deontay, that mandatories are kind of like flies. They're always buzzing around. How do you go about approaching a fight like this against an annoying fly?
Well, just like any fly, you're ready to crush them and kill them, you know? I wish I would have had my electric fly swatter. That would have been an easier kill. You know, but all seriousness, you know, with the history and the bad blood that we have against each other, you know, it's easy. It makes it easy to get up in the morning, makes it easy to go train and do what I got to do to prepare myself for this fight. And I've done that. I've turned every stone in camp. You know, I've trained just like a true champion should. And I'm looking forward to displaying my talent amongst the thousands that are going to be there and the millions that's going to be watching. It's going to be an amazing fight. And all that knows Deontay Wilder and have seen him in action, they know that I come to bring the pain and I come for dramatic knockouts. Because that's what the heavyweight division is all about. People don't want to see a 12-round fight. They want to see someone get knocked out. And that's one thing that I display. I display the dramatic knockout. And come May 18th, Saturday, you will see a dramatic knockout.
Deontay Wilder joining us. That is true, too. That's not just you talking. 40-0-1, 39 by knockout. And Deontay, you mentioned the bad blood. Brazil called you, quote, a disgrace for not only American boxing, but for heavyweight boxing in general, end quote. I know you know that quote. What is your reaction to that?
Well, you know, they all have to have something to say because they're not in the position. You know, jealousy is a disease. Envying is a disease, you know. If he was talented enough, he would have been champion a long time ago, but he's lacking the talent part of becoming a champion. So, of course, they had to have something to say. I'm the longest reigning champion, you know, and that speaks volume. That speaks for itself. What's understood doesn't have to be explained.
Deontay Wilder joining us. Now, you've said, quote, I've been up at 2 a.m. hitting the heavy bag for 12 rounds straight and still breathing smoothly. This is going to be a disaster for Brazil, end quote. It's a great quote. How do you see the fight going?
Man, knockouts. Like I always see it. Knockouts. I speak it, believe it, receive it, and it becomes mine. Like I tell people, your words are very powerful. I just talked to some elementary kids here in Brooklyn. I tell them, your words are powerful. Your mind is powerful. What you think is the law of attraction. It shall comes to you. And throughout my career, that's what I've done, and that's what I've displayed. You know, it's what I speak, you know, I believe. I'm passionate about how I react to things, my actions. I'm very passionate about it. And, you know, I just want people to – I'm a type of person that I practice what I preach, you know, and that's what been making me – that's what make me survive and became the longest reigning champion to this day. And I'm still carrying on that legacy. I'm still carrying on my name, and I'm looking for greatness, and that's what I shall receive.
And you are speaking it, Deontay, into existence. He is the heavyweight champion of the world. Hey, listen, if you and I go back to that fight against Tyson Fury, you were as light as you've ever been since making your professional debut. How much did you weigh for that fight, and how much do you think that impacted that fight?
Man, I weighed in at 212. By the time I had to weigh in again, official weigh in before the fight, I got up on the scale and I was 209. I was like, oh my God, how did I lose 3 pounds that fast overnight? And then shit, by the end of the fight, I probably was 212, yeah. So, I mean, I've already been a myth buster when it comes to boxing. Look, I'm untextbook, I'm unorthodox. You know, many people say, oh, you need strong legs to be able to have power. My legs is probably the smallest legs in the business. They say you need weight to carry to hang with the heavyweights. Look, I'm almost close to a cruiserweight, and I still have dramatic power, not only in the first round, but all the way through the 12th round. I told Fury, he's going to have to be perfect for 12 rounds. I only have to be perfect for 2 seconds. And what I speak, I believe, and I received.
The leader of the Bomb Squad, Deontay Wilder, is my guest. Now, in terms of weight, since then, you've been working with specialists to gain weight without losing your speed and your explosiveness. What's that process been like? And then what do you expect to weigh when you step in the ring on Saturday night?
Oh, man, the process has been – it's been torturing. I ain't going to lie. It's been interesting as well, too, because my nutritionist, she had me on 6 meals a day with 2 proteins, and it's been crazy just to try to fulfill my body with food, just eating when I'm not even hungry. That's the hard part, trying to eat when you're not hungry, man. I don't know anybody that tried to gain weight and try to eat when they're not hungry, but it's not fun, you know. And I've done that. That was part of training, and I had to stay disciplined. And you know, I've got on up to 226. We're all muscle, though. You know, when they did my scan for my body, I had a thin yellow line. The yellow line indicated my body fat, and I had very, very little starting out, and I'm probably still the same way now. So I'm lean, mean, I'm always a fighting machine, and I can't wait to display it, you know, come Saturday night. And who knows what my weight is going to be, man. My weight goes up and down. It's like the weather. It changes all the time. And we're going to see on the night of the fight what my what I weigh in as. And if I
Deontay,
if I don't come in the weight, if I don't come in the weight that I want, then it's not going to be no problem for me.
Deontay Wilder joining us. That fight's coming up on Saturday night. He is the WBC heavyweight champ. Now, Deontay, when you and I spoke in person in Atlanta before the Super Bowl, there was talk of an immediate rematch with Tyson Fury. How did the conversations go? And at a certain point, did you start to get the sense that they don't really want a rematch?
Most definitely. The conversation started out good. You know, we drew out the contract for him. We sent it to them. Fury and his team had the contract on the sitting on the desk for 5 days to a week. And all of a sudden, you know, they changed their mind. They went with the ESPN thing and the Bob Arum thing. But, you know, people were asking me, was I disappointed that they chose to decide to go that route? And I said, no, I'm not disappointed in that, because I understand as a fighter, we must look out for our health first. In that fight with me and Fury, I gave Fury a concussion. Not only did I give him a concussion, he had memory loss. This man didn't even know how he got knocked down, you know, nor did he know how he got up off the ground. He had memory loss, and that's something that is not good for your health. So I understand why they took a lesser route than coming back facing the champion. Look, he thought he, you know, with Showtime and the commentary with Fairhood scorecard, you know, when people on the outside looking in, they don't know how to judge the scorecard. And so they look towards experts to see what they're saying. So, you know, Fury said he outbeat me 12 rounds to 10. And I'm saying, if you think you beat me at that wide of a margin, then the rematch is easy to make. What other contender would not want to come in and do it again? Because knowing that if you beat me with that wide of margin, the second time would be a piece of cake with icing and a cherry on the top. But it wasn't the case. He knew what happened. I know what happened. And God knows what happened. That's why he didn't take the rematch. He wanted to go on to a lesser opposition that was ranked number 63 in the ranking, because they want to see that he still had this marbles left in his head after I've started knockout sense in his head. So, you know, now it goes on to where we are now. He signed with someone else. But the good thing about it is that, you know, I can move any way I want. These other guys have other networks that they sign with, and you know how it is in boxing. Some people work with some, and some work with others, and it's a mess. But the thing about me, I'm a wild card in this thing. I can work with anybody. So people don't have to worry about if the big fight is going to happen. The big fight is definitely going to happen. It's just taking a little time right now. But when it does, it's going to be an amazing fight again. And I can't wait. I can't wait to show everyone that I am the champion. I am the king. There's only one, and he hails from America, baby. There will be one champion, one face, one name, and he goes by the name of Deontay Wilder.
The Bronze Bomber. Deontay, before you go, you and I have also talked in the past about how you originally got into boxing because you wanted to make money so you could care for your daughter. You've made a ton of dough, so if that was the only motivation, you could walk away. So what is motivating you and driving you right now to keep on your grind and keep putting in the work?
Well, from that point of time, having my daughter, that was the goal. Now I add six more to the family, so I have seven in all. But what drives me most of all is generation wealth. My father wasn't able to break the chain. No, well, his father able to break the chain for him. But I'm in position to break the chain, and I will. So I'm looking for generation wealth. Not only will my children be okay, but their children and their children and their children would be just fine, you know. And that was giving me the motivation to keep carrying on, to keep doing what I'm doing. You know, I got a long way to go with it when you're talking about generation wealth. So that keeps me motivated, and I won't stop until I get it. Like, again, I say, I speak it, I believe it, and I shall receive it.
Deontay Wilder, my guest. Last thought, you called knockout because that's what you do. Do you have a round in mind, Deontay?
Say that one more time.
Do you have a round in mind? What round is this going to end on Saturday night?
Man, the way I'm feeling, I'd be surprised if the man go past three rounds. But, you know, I'm not going to be the typical fighter where people are thinking I'm going to come and be. I'm not going to be the typical fighter where he is training for. You think I'm going to come in wild and lose angry. You know, although we have bad blood, but I'm going to show people that I can keep my composure. Boxing is only being disciplined. And if you can be disciplined for 36 minutes, then you can know how you can show boxing skills. I'm looking forward to showing boxing skills in this fight. So what I'm planning on doing, I'm going to beat him up. Then once I beat him up, I'm going to knock him out. But I'm looking for early rounds in this fight. That's for sure.
Saturday night, 9 p.m., live, Showtime. The WBC heavyweight champion of the world, Deontay Wilder, going up against Brazil. He is the Bronze Bomber. He is the leader of the Bomb Squad. He is 40-0-1 and 39 of those wins by knockout. Deontay, always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much. I'll be watching Saturday.
My man, thank you so much, and y'all have a blessed day.
You too. Champ, Deontay Wilder in Los Angeles. Matt. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Romy Rome, the sass behind the glass. Thanks for the vine. From Redondo Beach to Rwanda, you're welcome. Since the days that the jungle was 4 hours strong, since Tim Johnson was lying to his Toronto Blue Jays squad about being a decorated Vietnam vet, your boy Matt in L.A. has been having your back while biding his time in the world's most notorious sports talk show, that is the jungle on the worldwide CBS Sports Net. What up, Taz? As I get in my reps, unlike that other Matt and his side piece Skyler in tandem, pulling on those elastic nylon resistance bands, partaking in hot yoga sessions as a new age smack-off training regimen, or doing a Jamal Murray Game 7 act and disappearing on the big stage like Mark and No-Show Boston did last year, I'm stepping my game up weekly, pimp, coming back hard always. And since it's smack-off season, I'm calling out that gravy train half-crown rocking has-been from the Midwest Mafia, a.k.a. Mikey Della Cream Pie. Hey, yo, DLC, Genie Buss thinks you're hiding out amidst the tumult, fam. That vulture carcass known as Vic and No-Call thinks you're non-existent these days. Why don't you put down your adult league YMCA basketball schedule for a minute, bro, and get back to business? Because you're an inferior slap-wielding, past-his-prime Terre Haute toolbox that ain't even the don of his own Parks and Rec League, son. So don't make me use these hands on you, you chump. I do declare you ain't squat, Mike. War Matt Pastry Dish Patricia ordering Grubhub from his regular season game day headset. War Belly Clarkson singing into Jack in a Box egg rolls. Unwar Rat Sphinxes in Glendale, John and Hermit Beach, and all you side-busting booches hiding behind Twitter. Outro.
Matt in L.A. So you're all waiting on it, aren't you? Matt, you still have your golden ticket. Rack him, Alvy. So my man's punching out of his class a little bit, right? Coming after all the big dogs. Mike in Indy, Mark in Boston, the VIC, and he is still holding on to that ticket. Mark in Boston coming right back. This guy's going back to back. Mark, what's going on?
Hey, funny call, Caleb. Wow, Rome, the run you're giving Caleb right now is the furthest this dude's ever run in his life. The kid is out of breath just listening. Caleb, thanks for not being hard on me, bro. Maybe that's because you don't know how to go hard on anything but your arteries. And the reason why I have a lot of kids is not because I'm chasing you in the odds. I'm going after the greats. I'm going after Alvin DeLauro. 4 kids, baby. You know why I take a lot of wrestling? Because I get a lot of wrestling. And, dude, I'm not saying this to be funny at all, but you're, like, seriously 5 years away from being a real 40-year-old virgin. I do not think Steve Carell appreciates the cosplay. I'm obscure on a radio show? Thanks? I don't even tell my wife I do this. You're not supposed to call and compliment me, bro. You can have radio fame. I'll go ahead and keep being a grown-up. And as far as your Twitter goes, buddy, sharing isn't always caring. I read the Twitter. You admit to being a virgin on a nationally syndicated radio show. Bro, what's your credit card number? Don't forget that 3-digit code on the back. I need that to get it to go through. I'm only going on your Twitter feed here. You don't even make the friend zone anymore, man. You make the sorry, I've switched team zone. Again, from your Twitter. So, yeah, I do love the Red Sox. But Caleb always loves his tube sock. Always has an...
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
I love smack-off season. 38 more days of this going into June 21st. Mark, the chorus of that song is not "We All Love the Tube Socks."
Good night.